I am Anna Urowitz Freudenstein, and I've been asked to come today to share some texts with you today. The problem is that I love Midrash, and I love texts, and it makes me happy, and today is not a day for happy. So I was very careful about choosing my texts today. They're ones that have the okay of the rabbis, that these are the ones that are suitable and appropriate to study for today. And it's very unusual for me to have to say to a crowd, a class, anyone, what I'm going to tell you, please don't enjoy yourself too much. Okay, that's my non-joke for Tisha B'Av. All right. So I have a title that's rather lengthy, Reactions to the Destruction of the First and Second Temples, Analysis of Midrash and Legend. So I better start off with explaining my title to you. First of all, reactions to the destruction. We're only going to talk about immediate reactions. Okay, there's two very famous reactions to destruction to the first temple. The obvious one would be 70 years later, rebuild again, new temple. And for the second temple, 65 years later, try to attempt to rebuild the Jewish state with the Bar Kokhba revolt, which was successful for 2 years, but unsuccessful afterwards. So for our purposes, I've mentioned them now, but we're not going to be discussing them. Those are further reactions. We're going to look at immediate reactions. So the immediate reaction, as we can only try to imagine, of the destruction of the central, social, religious, political, economic institution of your life and every other fellow Jew's lives, gone, not to mention your ability to directly connect with Hashem through sacrifices and everything else the Kohanim do, gone. All of that is gone, and so we would expect horror, shock, despair, and mourning. And certainly we get that, and we're going to see some examples of that. However, being the wonderful Jewish people that we are, for the most part, the Jews do not just sit and mourn and wallow, but rather quickly, many of them, important leaders among them, get up and say, wait a minute, this is horror that we've experienced, but what are we going to do, even immediately, to bring ourselves up and to correct ourselves and to do better for the future? So we're going to see some examples of that as well. Now, the next part of the title I just want to talk about is the First and Second Temples. This might be the historian in me talking, but I thought it was interesting just to think about a little bit the two different Batei Mikdash. I think that generally myself, maybe I'm only speaking for myself, but when we think of the Beit HaMikdash, we tend to think of the Second Beit HaMikdash. It's something I think that we can relate to a little bit better. It's closer in time to history, to time. Most of us have been to Jerusalem and have seen the Kotel and other kind of remnants and the physical layout, perhaps, of the Second Beit HaMikdash. Also, it's the one that we tend to talk about on Tisha B'Av, because Tisha B'Av, very often, when you talk about, you know, we talk about trying to make ourselves better using the fast and the day as a day of introspection, and we try to learn lessons from the past. And in the past, we all know that the reason for the destruction of the Second Temple was sinat hinam, baseless hatred, Jew against Jew. This is something that's terribly important for all of us to remember and to learn from, and a way that we can improve our own lives, and many rabbis and teachers have taught us that before. Going back to the First Temple, though, a little bit harder for us to relate to, because the reason for the destruction of the First Temple, the three big sins, murder, idolatry, and illegal or illicit sexual relations. So hopefully, thank God, most of us cannot relate to those reasons on a personal level. And so therefore, I think the lessons from the First Temple are not only further back in history, but also a little bit more removed from our personal experiences, so therefore difficult for us to relate to. Nevertheless, Tisha B'Av is a day to commemorate the destruction of that as well as the Second Temple, as well as, of course, many other atrocities that have happened to us in Jewish history. So I just thought it was important to remember the First Temple as well, and some of the texts that we look at are going to be doing that. Finally, the last part of the title, an analysis of Midrash and legend. Many people would say, Midrash is just a legend. No, I'm making a distinction here. The Midrashim that we'll be looking at are actually Midrashim brought to us by the rabbis and preserved for us in books of Midrashim, or we'll see one that has been preserved for us in the Talmud. What I'm calling legends are other Jewish, ancient Jewish sources that you'll see here on the source sheet, and I'll explain to you where they're from, that are not part of rabbinic literature, were not passed down to us from the rabbis, but nevertheless were written by ancient Jews, and so I think are interesting for us to look at as well. Okay, there's our title and our introduction, really. So now we can go right ahead, into the first idea. So as you see also, I'm sorry, there's tons and tons of words on the source sheets. Please do not be frightened. There is not going to be an exam. You do not need to memorize them. And also, we might not even get through every single word together. Some of the texts, I think, are a little bit more familiar to many people, so maybe we can just summarize those and not have to read them word by word. But hopefully we're going to at least get to all the main ideas in the text that I have on the handout for you. So as you can see, for each one, what I've done is I've given you a title where I've taken it from. And I've also let you know if it's from the First Temple or Second Temple period. I believe. I don't have a copy in front of me. And then I also gave a tiny little one-word thematic introduction to the text. So basically what I gave, I separated the text not only into whether they reflect a First Temple idea or a Second Temple idea, but also whether they reflect one of two themes, that of sorrow, which is more passive, or action, which of course is action, and that's the part that I was mentioned before about picking up quickly and moving on, action. All right, so the first one, though, I think as appropriate and as the tone of the day of Tisha B'Av in general, is that we'll go with the sorrow ones first, with the sad kind of passive ones, and then just like the tone of the day post-mincha, when the number of the halachot of Tisha B'Av change also, and the mood of the day changes to be a little bit more of hopefulness and a little bit more upbeat, so to the second category of text will reflect that idea as well. So the first one, as I hopefully, or maybe or may not be obvious, is what's an immediate reaction to sorrow is actually, I'm calling it passive, but it's somewhat active in that it's creative. It's the prophet Yirmiyahu, who's traditionally believed to be the author of Megillat Eicha, spilling out his heart in the book of Eicha. So writing out these sad poems and these sad poems. So the book of Eicha itself would be a reaction to destruction. And, of course, that would be of the first Beit HaMikdash. Now, I just thought it would be interesting to just reflect a little bit on me associating Yirmiyahu with the book of Eicha, because, of course, his name does not appear in the book itself. It's traditionally believed and discussed in the Talmud that he is the author of it. And Rashi actually summarizes those ideas in his comments on the first Pasuk of Megillat Eicha, where he talks about this interesting way that Megillat Eicha was written, that three of the chapters were actually written before the destruction as a kind of prophecy and a warning to the Jews and to the king of the Jews at the time to say, you know, these are all the horrible things that we're doing, we must repent, we must change, we must do better, and if we don't, this is what's going to happen. That was presented to the king, who rejected it, actually tore it up and burnt it. But later, those same three chapters were remembered and were written down with the two other chapters post-destruction. So the entity as a whole, and certainly two chapters of it, at the very least, we can see as an immediate reaction or relatively immediate reaction to the destruction. So that's the rabbinic idea and belief, but I just thought it was interesting to show you what I brought here. It's an English translation of introduction, I guess, a one-liner introduction, one-sentence introduction to the book of Eicha from the ancient book, the Septuagint, which is the first Greek translation of the Bible, Jewish translation. And there are some changes, some additions that are different from our text that we have of the Tanakh today. One of them being that there is a one-line intro to Sefer Eicha, to Megillat Eicha, and I have it written there for you. and it basically associates precisely Yirmiyahu not only with the book, but that it's written as a direct reaction. And I'll just read you that one pre-verse. Maybe it's not a verse. It's a kind of a pre-verse. And it came to pass after Israel was taken captive and Jerusalem made desolate that Yirmiyahu sat weeping and lamented with this lamentation over Yerushalayim and said, and then goes right away into the first pasuk. And I just brought you that first pasuk to show you the context. So again, it's a rabbinic idea, but it's interesting to see an ancient Jewish non-rabbinic idea reflect the same concept. So, now we'll go on with other examples of sorrow. Two from Midrashim. The next one we have is from Midrash Eicha Rabbah. And it is, I'll read it for you. Rabbi Yochanan adduced 60 episodes to illustrate the Lord had swallowed up unsparingly. So it's a quote from Eicha there, and he's trying to explain how horrific the tragedy was of the destruction, all of the horrors. And we know, of course, in the book of Eicha is unfortunately many, many examples of horrible horrors that happened during the siege and the destruction of Yerushalayim. And so as part of understanding those more and adding and commenting on them more, there's this Rabbi Yochanan, and we'll see in a minute Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi are participating in a conversation explaining those horrors. So he was able to figure out 60 different episodes of horror that had happened as part of the destruction. But Rabbi here, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, could only come up with 24 examples of horrors that happened in connection with the destruction. Now, that seems to be unusual. This is something to stand up and notice, because Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi was the Nasi. He was the head of the Jewish people at the time. He was the person that put together the Mishnah eventually. He was an incredibly brilliant rabbi. So it would be kind of unusual for he to only come up with 24 examples versus his rabbinic colleague who was able to come up with 60 examples. So because this is surprising, the Midrash here actually is able to give us an explanation as to why this unusual thing was true. The reason is that Rabbi was nearer in time to the destruction of the temple. His recollection was so vivid that when he recounted the episodes, he wept and he had to be comforted. So I think this is a very interesting, I want to say the word beautiful, but it's not a beautiful thing, but it's this display of emotion by the head of the Jewish people, the rabbinic head of the Jewish people. That he was busy teaching Torah, explaining Torah, and yet he actually literally had to stop himself because he was weeping. He was weeping over the destruction and could not finish his examples. And yet his other colleague was able to, but that he was not. I think it's a very interesting thing to demonstrate and to show the intimacy of emotion that this revered rabbi had in this particular instance. I just want to keep in mind, though, when we say that he his recollection was so vivid, it's a little bit of an exaggeration, because the Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi is responsible for the redaction of the Mishnah in the year 200. The destruction is in the year 70. So he probably didn't experience it himself. He didn't live quite that long. But his recollection, I'm assuming, from a parent, from a teacher, from a rabbi, was more direct. It was more of a direct recollection. It wasn't exact, but at least it was more direct and something that he felt in his heart and let it spill out of his heart and wept as he was learning Torah with his students and colleagues because of the true emotion that he felt. So within the topic of weeping, we have another midrash, this one brought down to us in the Talmud, our next example. However, I have to tell you, it was increasingly difficult to find examples of reactions, and of course I've only brought you a small section of them today, right? There are, of course, many other midrashim and ideas I could have brought. I've only brought you a selection. But it was very difficult, thank God, to find ones that were only focused on the bad. Very often, I think people would say this is probably the Jewish way, and this is, you know, the reason for our survival, is that it's very hard to talk about only the bad, only the sorrow, only the mourning, without at least coming out on the positive side as well. And of course, we even see this reflected in the book of Echa as well, right? The prime example of sorrow and mourning and crying, even there are hints and ideas of hopefulness in it, especially at the very end, or almost at the end, which I will talk about in a few minutes' time. So the next example there of sorrow is one that's connected to one of hope. So it's actually a lovely segue into this second collection. I made a little line there on the handout. A second theme that we'll be talking about, the one of action, of moving forward to the future, as opposed to just stagnating in the very sad, sad present. So the one here that is sorrow moving into hope, is one that is of the Second Temple period. And it's a discussion of rabbis. And this one, of course, is very famous. I'm certain that many of you have heard it before. It has to do with Rabbi Akiva, internal optimist. But before we get to the optimism part, though, I just want to, of course, emphasize the weeping and the sorrow part, because that's the kind of continuation or end of this theme. I'll read. Once again, this is actually a continuation of a number of stories. I've only shared one of them, a similar story. It's one of them with you here. Once again, this is a group of rabbis, were coming up to Jerusalem together, just as they came to Mount Scopus, to one of the particular areas. They saw a fox emerging from the Holy of Holies, from the location where the Kodesh HaKodeshim had been before the destruction. They, these other rabbis, fell a-weeping, started crying again, outpouring of emotion. And Rabbi Akiva seemed merry. He was happy in direct opposition to them. And, of course, this is very perplexing, and they had to ask him, "Wherefore," said they to him, "are you merry? Why are you so happy? We are witnessing here the direct aftermath of the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. We are seeing it now. How is it that you can be happy?" And again here, he's able to take the sorrow and turn it into optimism for the future. But he has to do so through a relatively lengthy commentary or exegesis of a number of texts. So I'll take you through it. Said they to him, this is their continuation of their talking to him. "A place which it was once said, and the common man that draweth nigh shall be put to death." That's so holy was the Holy of Holies of Kodesh HaKodeshim. No one could even go to it, you know, except for the Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur. Otherwise, you would be liable for death. It has now become the haunt of foxes, right? So, so, so holy. And now just wild animals are roaming around on it. Shouldn't we weep? Shouldn't we be just in despair about this? Said he to them, "Therefore I'm merry." No, that's exactly why I'm happy. And he's going to explain why. "For it is written," "it is written," and he's quoting here from Yeshayahu, "and I will take to me faithful witnesses to record, Uriah the priest and Zechariah." So we have two leaders here in Israel, and they're put together, even though they don't really seem logically like they would go together. But now that Rabbi Akiva is going to put them together, he's going to learn a lesson from it. He continues with his lesson. "Now what connection has this Uriah the priest with Zechariah? Uriah lived during the times of the first temple, when the other Zechariah lived and prophesied during the second time temple period." They're separated by hundreds of years. But the Tanakh linked the latter, in that pasuk he just quoted, linked the latter prophecy of Zechariah with the early prophecy of Uriah. "In the early prophecy, in the days of Uriah, was written, 'Therefore shall Zion for your sake be plowed as a field.'" That field and wild animals, like, totally natural, wild, you know, the place where wild animals could go. "In Zechariah it is written, 'Thus saith the Lord of hosts, there shall yet be men and women sit in the broad places of Yerushalayim.'" That means that, like, people can sit and enjoy and be living in Yerushalayim again. So the exact opposite of being torn up and back to a state of nature. "Thus saith the Lord of hosts," Hashem, "there shall..." "As long as Uriah's threatening prophecy has not had its fulfillment, I had misgivings that Zechariah's prophecy may not be fulfilled." If I didn't see the total and utter destruction, total return to nature, then I think, well, maybe these prophecies are, God forbid, not true. Maybe the good stuff isn't going to happen. If the bad stuff doesn't totally happen that was unfortunately promised us, because we you know, for our sins. If the bad stuff hadn't happened, then maybe we couldn't rely that the good stuff was going to happen too. So now that he's putting those two ideas together, and so I've just basically summarized the rest for you. He said basically there are these horrible, horrible prophecies. I need to see that all of that comes absolutely true, so that I can believe and have hope for the future, for the unimaginable future. I'm living here amongst destruction, and yet I can have hope that even though it's so hard for me to imagine it, a prophecy said it's going to come true. Well, if the bad prophecy came true, then I'm going to have to believe that the good prophecy is going to come true as well. And the message was successfully taken by his fellow rabbis, and the end of the Midrash says, Akiva, Akiva, you have comforted us. You have comforted us. So he was able to take their weeping in his explanations of his understanding of Torah and really of faith and hope for the future, was able to turn them around and to demonstrate to them that, unfortunately, we've had to suffer for our sins in the past, but God has promised us good for the future as well. And even if we can't feel it right now, that I, Akiva, know that it's coming. Okay, so I've turned the wave now from our sorrow and despair and passivity into hopefulness. We haven't seen the action yet. I'm going to show some other ideas here that show some of this action and movement towards the future. It's a little bit confusing, though, because even though I'm talking about the future, I'm going to go back in time a little bit, though, back to the first temple period. Because I think it's interesting to see some of the reflections that came from the destruction of the first temple versus the second temple. The truth is, I'm just going to throw these ideas out to you, and I'm not 100% sure what to make of them myself. I think probably I'm having this trouble of going back and trying to psychoanalyze these people of what they might have felt like in history. And what would it have felt like after the first destruction? But you didn't know it was the first destruction. For you living in the first temple period, it was the only destruction. Did you have an occasion for a hopefulness for the future? Would that have been more despair or less despair than having experienced the second temple destruction? Then would that be more hopeful to you because you realize, oh, God didn't totally abandon us. God, had a second temple or has embraced us and let us continue on to the future. Could you feel hopefulness that as a survivor of the second temple? Or could you perhaps feel more despair because you thought, oh, boy, we really blew it now. God did it, punished us horribly, deservedly the first time around. Now he did it the second time around. Even though there's the breed all the way through the Tanakh, and we know that God promises not going to totally forget us, having lived through that sorrow the second time, I don't know if that would have led to more despair or more hopefulness based on an individual's personal reflection about what they knew about their own people's history. So it's just an idea I want to throw out for you. Of course, I don't know the answers. And all the way through, actually, now that I mentioned about an individual, I think it's important also for us to remember these ideas that we have for us are ideas that were written down either by the rabbis or even these other non-rabbinic ideas that we'll see in a moment by leaders of the community. So we know, but we're assuming that leaders and rabbis, I would assume, having that role, that they would have be able to look ahead to the future, perhaps have optimism, have an idea of planning, have a more of a supreme faith, perhaps, in Hashem. Those are the ideas that we have reflected in these texts. Of course, like it's true for most of ancient history, we don't know what the common person thought. So we have an idea, an inkling of an idea from some of these texts about what our leaders and rabbis thought. But in terms of an ordinary individual, how their life was transformed and how they might have felt when their center, political, religious, spiritual, economic, everything center completely wiped out, we have no record of that. So that's the kind of thing that we can use, kind of historical imagination, try to imagine how they might have felt, but I will leave that up to you. Okay. So let's go on, though, and talk about, I've brought some of these ideas that are legends. I've entitled them legends because, as I mentioned before, they're not found in the rabbinic corpus. They're not in the Midrash. They're not in the Talmud or anything like that. The first one I've brought to you is from the second book of Maccabees. So people, of course, have heard the word Maccabees associated with the holiday of Hanukkah, and of course Hanukkah associated with the Beit HaMikdash. The second book of the Maccabees is found in a collection of books called the Apocrypha, which some people hopefully will have heard of. The Apocrypha is basically a grouping of books that are considered holy, actually, by the Roman Catholic Church and the Greek Orthodox Church, not the Protestants. And they're ancient Jewish texts that were not preserved by the rabbis, but were usually actually preserved by the church, by various churches. But they were written by Jews, and within the last 100-plus years, Jews, and particularly Jewish historians, have embraced these by saying, wow, this is so interesting. We have these texts that reflect an ancient Jewish history that are outside of the rabbinic worldview. And it's interesting to utilize them also when we try to understand our history. So there are actually four books of the Maccabees. Two of them are in the Apocrypha. And this second book of they kind of retell the same story in slightly different ways. The second book of the Maccabees is more religious than the first, more spiritual. And as part of introductory section, as you see, the quote here is just from chapter 2. So of the book of Maccabees, there's a recapping of certain aspects of history that would have led up to the Hasmonean period when the Hasmonaim took back the temple during the holiday that we now celebrate as Hanukkah. And as part of that mini review of history, of course, they emphasize things on the Beit HaMikdash, something they were terribly interested in. And there's a very interesting quote here. Okay? So I stress that we're going to read this. This is not a midrash, but it is another ancient Jewish idea that was not preserved for us by the rabbis. It was also in the writing the writing is because the second book of the Maccabees is supposed to be a rephrasing of an even more ancient text. That the prophet, and we'll see that it's the prophet Jeremiah as we read on, having received an oracle, right, a prophet, it's like a kind of nevuah, a prophecy, ordered that the tent, so something to do with the Ohel Moed, something like that, and the ark should follow with him, and he went out to the mountain where Moses had gone up and had seen the inheritance of God, Har Nebo, where Moses died and was buried. And Yirmiyahu came and found a cave, and he brought there the tent, the ark, and the altar of incense, so all stuff that was supposed to belong in the first Beit HaMikdash, and he sealed up the entrance. So the idea is here that Yirmiyahu, the idea is that as he was experiencing the destruction before the temple was completely destroyed, and when we're going to actually see these few examples that we have when we talk about action, when you're taking action, sometimes you don't wait till the destruction's completely finished. Sometimes you have to act mid-destruction. And he acted mid-destruction, realizing the temple was going to be destroyed, and he'd better save those kelim, those temple implements, because they're holy and important, and I'm assuming he had optimism and hope for the future of the Jewish people, that they could be reused again someday. And the idea is that he went there to Jerusalem and then took them and hid them in a secret place. What's the secret place? Same secret burial of where Moshe was buried. Some of those who followed him, so this is already a very strange and unusual thing, and apparently the people who were around him, according to this idea, thought it was pretty strange and unusual too. So they followed him and came up to mark the way because they didn't want it to be secret. They wanted to know where that stuff was going to be. Presumably, I'm hoping that these were Jews who were hoping that they'd be able to put them to good use one day soon again, but they could not find it. Just like you cannot find the place where Moshe is buried, it is a miraculous idea that it is completely secret. When Yirmiyahu learned of it, he rebuked them. That's what the prophet does, right? He rebukes and declared, "The place shall be unknown until God gathers his people together again and shows his mercy." So, of course, the idea of God gathering his people together again reminds us of the idea of the Mashiach, when we will all be collected together. The idea is that these vessels needed to be preserved so that they could be reused at that time. So it's a very interesting idea, and we're going to see another idea from a similar text next about mid-destruction having to save those Beit HaMikdash, the kelim of the Beit HaMikdash, the implements, so that they would be able to be reused in a future date. Future, though, of course, if you're living in the first temple period, you don't know if that's going to be a second temple, which actually did happen, or if it's going to be a different kind of more heavenly temple and that the Mashiach will come, right? If you're living in the destruction of the first temple, you don't know that there's going to be a second temple necessarily the way history experienced it. Your hopefulness might be actually for Mashiach and the Beit HaMikdash that would be built with them, along with the Mashiach, or before the Mashiach, depending on your understanding of Messianic times, which is a whole topic in and of itself, which we will not be talking about today. So here's this very strange idea. And of course, I'm assuming that many people, right away when we're talking about secrecy involving temple implements and, you know, where all this stuff goes, everyone knows about all those theories about the Vatican hiding the menorah and, you know, all that stuff. I don't know anything about that, so we're not going to be talking about that today. But it's just so interesting, and of course perhaps not surprising, to see very ancient texts attributing such importance to these artifacts and having the desire or the concept of preserving them for future use. So we have another, even more kind of miraculous or otherworldly version of the story that I'm going to show you next, again in our legend category, or not our Midrash category, but legend. And this one is from a book called Second Baruch, the second book of Baruch. Now Baruch is Baruch ben Neriah, the scribe of our same prophet Yirmiyahu. Right? So the idea is, and the question is, if how much of Sefer Yirmiyahu did Yirmiyahu write? How much did Baruch write? And the idea of him being a scribe, though, was really taken up in ancient times, and there were different beliefs about him even writing his own books as well. So this particular book is found in a genre of literature called the pseudepigrapha. So sometimes there's two categories. One I talked about a minute ago, the apocrypha, and the pseudepigrapha are sometimes linked together. Basically what they are is, again, ancient texts not preserved by the rabbis, but for the most part written by Jews, which reflected other Jewish, usually non-rabbinic ideas from the first few centuries before the common era, like before zero, and maybe about a century or two post the year zero. Not books that are necessarily wildly known to Jewish public, but ones that are studied now by Jewish historians because they have such wonderful information for us from a time period where we have very little other literary evidence about what Jewish life was like. So the pseudepigrapha is this large genre of literature. It's called pseudepigrapha because most of the books in it, the word pseudo means fake, and epigrapha are writings, so are fake writings. Because usually, in order to make these books seem more authentic, even though they were written in a post-biblical period, very often they were written under the pen name of a biblical character. And so, you know, Abraham, many, many of them are used. So it's a book that's written after the Tanakh was finished, but they take one character from the Tanakh and pretend that he is the author of that book. And so it would give it more credence and more weight to an ancient audience of readers. So this Baruch is an obscure person from the Tanakh, but nevertheless mentioned the Tanakh. And he tells his version of the same idea of something very miraculous happening with those first temple kelim or implements. And this one is much more spectacular. There are angels involved. And it came to pass on the morrow that, lo, the army of the Chaldees, that's the Babylonians, surrounded the city. This is the siege of Jerusalem. And at the time of the evening, I, Baruch, so he now, as you see, he becomes the star of the story. It's not Yirmiyahu anymore, his boss, but he in this version is the main character. I, Baruch, left the people, and I went forth and stood by the oak. And I was grieving over Zion. I was watching this whole destruction happening or about to happen, and lamenting over the capacity which had come into the people. And lo, suddenly a strong spirit raised me and bore me aloft over the wall of Jerusalem. So now we're getting into an otherworldly kind of story, and he's, but we see similar ideas with in prophecies in the Tanakh as well, this one perhaps a little bit more exaggerated. And I beheld, and lo, four angels standing at the four corners of the city, each of them holding a torch of fire in his hands, a very spectacular scene. And another angel began to descend from heaven and said unto them, hold your lamps, do not light them until I tell you. So the idea is here, and we see this idea in other, not exactly this way, but in different ways in a different rabbinic text, that Yerushalayim is Yerushalayim. There's no way that an earthly king, Nebuchadnezzar, would have been able to destroy the city himself. He is an agent of God, because God is punishing the people, and so there has to be a miraculous element to enable Nebuchadnezzar to be successful in destroying Yerushalayim. So this is, it's related to that to a certain extent. For I am, so the idea is here, these angels were going to, with God's permission, were going to help along Nebuchadnezzar in this destruction of Jerusalem. But they were held off temporarily. For I am first to speak a word to the earth and to place it in it, and to place in it what the Lord the Most High has commanded me. And I saw him descend, this angel, into the Holy of Holies and take from there the veil, I guess the parochet, and the holy ark and the mercy seat and two tables and the holy remnant of the priests. I would have loved to look these up in Hebrew for you to tell you exactly what they are, but the original Hebrew, we do believe this was originally written in Hebrew, but it has been lost to us. We don't have it anymore. I believe the ancient version we have is in, I think, in Syriac, or maybe in Greek, or in Syriac, an ancient form of Aramaic. And so and the altar of incense and the 48 precious stones where the priest was adorned on the breastplate and all the holy vessels of the tabernacle. And he spoke, this angel spoke to the earth with a loud voice, earth, 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 hear the word of the mighty God and receive that I commit to you and guard them unto the last times for their perspective when the Mashiach comes, so that when you are ordered, you may restore them, so that strangers may not get possession of them. For the time comes when Jerusalem will be delivered for a time until it is said that it is again restored forever. And the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up. Okay, so this is, no one's going to find that hiding place, right? There's certainly absolutely miraculous spiritual element to this, otherworldly element, that there are these holy implements that must be preserved because we have to have hope for the future that they will be used again. And they're tahor, they're pure. We don't want them touched by or dealt with improperly by impure people, by conquerors. And so this is a way to preserve them for the future. Okay, so we had a hidden cave before, which, you know, you could maybe find. Here, you're not going to find. Totally swallowed up. And, of course, we have the idea of the mouth of the earth used for very, very different ways in the Tanakh itself, right in the Chumash when it comes to Korach. Here, it's used in different ways, but I'm just as I can't imagine that story when the rebellious Korach and his followers are swallowed up by the earth. I can't picture it in my mind's eye. I also can't picture this one exactly. But nevertheless, we can be assured that this would be a very safe and secure place for these Kalim, because certainly God, and as orchestrated by God's angels, made this miracle happen for them to be swallowed up. So too, in the right time, God would be able to, I guess, issue them forth again when they're to be used. Now, when it comes to legend also, I just want to mention one more, and that's the next one. It has to do with this book called it's not a book, it's like a 3-page essay called Masechet Kelim. When starting to do the research for this idea, I came across, it said Masechet Kelim. I'm like, oh, okay, I'll check out Masechet Kelim. It's a Masechet in the Mishnah. It's called Masechet Kelim. It's part of the Mishnah. So I'm like, oh, I'll go check it out. And I scanned through the whole thing, and there was supposed to be this interesting idea about during the destruction of the first temple that these other people who were Kohanim and Leviim took the same temple implements out of the, saved them from the burning temple and whisked them away to a safe place in a different country and held them in a tower and held them there. I'm like, gee, I don't remember learning that story anywhere. And I look for it in Masechet Kelim, and it's not there in the Mishnah. Well, it turns out there's another book called Masechet Kelim, and it's very obscure, and there's only, I wrote it down for you here. It's not mentioned before the 17th century. So I put that in the category of legend, because I tend to think of Midrash as being ancient Midrash, you know, more like from the time of the Talmud or the Midrashim. 17th century already sounds pretty darn modern to me. So even though the idea might have been a little bit more ancient, there's no record of it in Jewish thought before this particular text. So I put this one, personally I would put this one into the category of legend as well. But it's a similar idea. The idea is mid-destruction, action had to happen to save what is most important for the future. Now that I've recounted those three legends, and hopefully they were some new ideas and therefore hopefully a little bit interesting to you, I have to tell you the truth, and I think I even included it in there because it was so outstanding and unusual to me that I felt I even had to include it in the handout. Those legends are total contradictions to the Tanakh itself. The Tanakh itself is a little bit difficult to understand because there are many different psukim from Divrei Hayamim, for the books towards the end of the Tanakh, that talk about the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash and what happened to the Kelim, those same implements, and then what happened once Ezra and Nehemiah were given permission to rebuild the temple and which implements they used for the second temple. According to the Tanakh, those Kelim were taken away as booty to Babel. And Nebuchadnezzar had them there in his palace. And then when the change of leadership, and Cyrus was now the head of the empire and gave permission for the Jews to go back and start rebuilding, he said, look, I've got this stuff for you. Take it back and use it to rebuild your temple. So it's an interesting idea because that idea, it's a little bit confusing in the Tanakh because there's a few different stages and there are a few different psukim in a few different books that talk about these different golden things being taken out of the Bible, and it seems like they were taken at different time periods. So either they're contradictory in the Tanakh, which is a difficult thing theologically to present, or they perhaps reflect different parts of the destruction, because the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash really did happen in stages. It wasn't a one-year deal. There were a number of different stages, an earlier exile, an earlier conquering, and things like that. So perhaps those implements were taken out in little bits and pieces at different times. But nevertheless, it seems as if they all ended up in Babel, and then they were given permission to bring them back. So again, I'm trying to psychoanalyze ancient minds, and of course, this is just an idea. I don't have the answer. It'd be interesting. Well, I don't think we have the time to share necessarily, but it's an interesting thing to think about. Why is it that these other ancient writers felt it so important to preserve these holy implements in a miraculous, secretive way versus being held in the impure temple or palace, I guess, / temple of Nebuchadnezzar in Babel? I mean, that has a kind of a distasteful feeling to it, even though Nebuchadnezzar and his people are, you know, agents of God, and they're supposed to be doing, you know, they do the destruction because we sinned and God sent him, and so maybe it's part of the plan that he should also hang on to this stuff, and then it would be sent back to Jerusalem, you know, 70-ish years later. But I can also see that the idea of wanting to keep these holy implements safe and pure, and put away because Jewish hands put them away, as opposed to being off in that palace. I could see that would, I think to some, perhaps would be, a more tasteful, more comfortable position. So it's just an idea I'm throwing out. But nevertheless, the two ideas exist. We have the idea that's in the Tanakh. You're welcome. The one pasuk that talks about, I just quoted it here for you. I won't read it for us about Ezra, about when they actually come back. But there are a number of different psukim that talk about those different implements being taken away and held there by Nebuchadnezzar. Okay, so then we have those examples of action, preparation for the future, for a future Beit HaMikdash, whether it's an earthly one or a more earthly/messianic one. And then we have other ideas about action that are related to Torah. So these are the ones, of course, that are not surprising that are found in rabbinic texts, in Midrashim. And the first one that I've quoted only a small portion for you because it's a very lengthy story here in Bavli Gittin in the Talmud about how it is that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was able to preserve Torah learning for the Jewish people, even though the Second Temple, center of Jewish learning until that time, was being destroyed. And it's a very fabulous, exciting story. I'm sure many of you know it, having to do with Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai being secreted out of Yerushalayim that was still under siege, and talking to Vespasian, who was not yet the emperor but soon to become the emperor, about speaking to him and then able to get a favor from him to secure the town of Yavne to be the future seat or the seat of the of Jewish learning from then on. So even though Jerusalem would be destroyed, that now in the midst of destruction, or even before ultimate destruction actually happens, it's time to think of a new Jewish center for the Jewish people. And he recommends this small town of Yavne. And that is in fact what happened. The center of the Jewish people shifted, although changed drastically, because it's no longer a temple. It's now yeshivot and places for rabbis to sit and to learn Torah, but now becomes Yavne. So I have part of the story for you here. I'm not going to bother reading it. You can look at it on your own. I just have to share something that's a little bit tricky, though, because this, I think, is the most famous version of this particular story. I might be a little bit prejudiced because it is part of the grade 10 curriculum in Jewish history at Chet. So I've taught it many times there, and some of your children might have seen it there. But there's a different version of this story that is found, that I was surprised to see, in the Midrash of Eicha, of Eicha Rabbah, where there's a similar kind of escaping from burning Yerushalayim, or besieged Yerushalayim, getting out, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai getting out, and being able to, through a number of different issues, being able to ask a favor of the soon-to-be emperor. And he doesn't ask for Yavne there. He asks for Yerushalayim to be saved, which he doesn't ask for in this other version. That is turned down. But then he asks for a portion of the Temple Mount to be saved, and happens to be the western portion, where, of course, we still have the Kotel Maravi today. So it's an interesting different version. It's interesting, reflective of an outpouring of emotion. You would imagine if the emperor says, what favor do you want to have? The first thing you should ask for is to save Jerusalem. It's not, oh, by the way, give me this little town called Yavne. So in this version, this other version I didn't share with you today, he does ask for Yerushalayim. It's turned down, unfortunately. But is asked for a little bit of a favor that in the midst of destruction and burning, that something will be preserved. And it just so happens that that is the portion that I guess that we would figure out would be the Kotel Maravi today. Okay, so that's the story. That's the action. That's the institutionalized action of saying we are going to lose out on the institution of the temple. We are going to now establish the institution of formal Torah study in this town called Yavne. And what comes out of that is a continuation and a growth and an evolution and a flowering of the kind of Torah study that we know of today that started then in the time of the Mishnah and the Talmud and, of course, thank God, continues even until today. So there's that kind of institutionalized action having to do with Torah. And there's one more midrash, though, that I brought here that has to do with action and Torah, which seems a little bit more personalized, not only institutionalized. And I thought it was really lovely, although I know we're not supposed to be enjoying these midrashim, but I thought it was lovely, and that's one I wanted to share with you, and then maybe it's just a thought to finish it up. So this has to do, if you look at the last text that I shared with you, it is a commentary on a very beautiful but unusual pasuk, from Megillat Eicha. As I mentioned in the very beginning, even though Megillat Eicha is filled with sorrow and mourning and lamentations, after all, that's what it's called, in fact, there are little glimmers of hope throughout, sometimes mentioned in the text. And one of those particular verses is the one that is being commented on here, Zot Ashiv Alibi Al Ken Ochiel. This I recall in my mind, therefore I have hope. Okay, so taking off on that, this midrash is going to share with us a mashal, a parable, and then going to explain it. Rabbi Abba Bar Kohana said in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, to what may this be likened, this particular pasuk? To a king who has married a lady and made a large written settlement. I'm adding the word written. You'll see in a minute. It's a written settlement upon her, a document, perhaps a kind of ketubah, I don't know, saying to her, so many state apartments I'm preparing for you, so many fine linen garments I'm giving to you, all the things I will promise to you. The king left, made all these promises in writing, and left. Departed to a distant country and tarried there, stayed away. Her neighbors of this poor woman visited her and vexed her by telling her, the king has left you, gone away to a distant country, will never return to you. She wept, right? Here's her sorrow, and sighed. But whenever she entered her room, she opened the chest where it was deposited, this document, took out her settlement and read it. On seeing therein, so many state apartments I'm preparing for you, so many fine purple garments I'm giving you, she was at once comforted. Eventually the king returned, and he said to her, my daughter, I wonder how you've waited for me all these years. How did you manage to do it? She answered, my lord king, had it not been for the generous settlement which you wrote and gave me, my neighbors would long ago have caused me to perish. I would have been in such despair. In like manner, now we need the nimshal, the heathens vexed Israel by saying to them, your God has hidden his face from you and removed his Shekhinah from your midst by destroying the Beit HaMikdash. He will return no more. We weep and sigh. But what do? Not just weep and sigh. No, action. Then, and when we entered their synagogues and houses of study and read in the Torah being the written document filled with promises, and find written therein, and I will have respect unto you and make you fruitful and multiply you. I will set my tabernacle among you. I will walk among you. We are comforted. In the time to come, when the era of the redemption arrives, the time of the Mashiach, the Holy One, blessed be He, will say to Israel, my sons, I wonder how you waited for me all these years. And we will speak before Hashem and say, Lord of the universe, had it not been for thy Torah, which thou just has given us, the heathen peoples would long ago, peer pressure, would have caused us to give in and caused us to perish. Therefore, it is stated, this I recall to my mind, this, the word zot in Hebrew, indicates nothing other than the Torah, as it is said, v'zot ha-Torah. So the word zot, for zot ashiv alibi, was the pasuk from Eicha, and then v'zot ha-Torah, associating those two zots together. It says, what is it that we recall? What is it in our mind always that holds us and continues to give us hope for the future? Is Torah. So I think that's, if I'm allowed to leave on an uplifting note, I think that's not a bad one to leave with. Just wanted to share with you one other thing then, speaking of endings and slight upliftings, the ending of the book of Eicha. So the ending of the book of Eicha, you know, is very strange because the last pasuk is very depressing. The second last pasuk, though, is the one that is more uplifting, and therefore that's why the rabbis have told us, well, that's why you repeat that one at the end. Remember that from the Eicha reading last night, the second last. You read through all the way, and then at the end, you repeat the second to last verse again. And that's a very famous verse, right? Hashivenu, Hashivenu, Hashem Elecha ben Ashuva Hadesh Yamenu Kekedem. Right? So the idea is there, I was thinking about, just to conclude, of course, this is return to God. The Torah is helping us do that based on the last midrash that we just read. But think about the idea about passive and active, right? We had those passive reactions to destruction I talked about in the beginning. When I say passive, I'm not passing judgment on that and saying that that was bad. I'm just saying, well, that was necessary at that time for those people. But there were other people that, thank God, to the other version also, took action, were more active. But really, the passivity and the activity are both, I guess, part of human nature, the idea of mourning, and are both parts and combined in this reaction to destruction. And in that particular pasuk where we say, Hashivenu, we're calling out to God, we're being active in doing that, you know, return us to you, Hashem, and then, so that we can return. It's actually interesting. There are different English translations of that vinashuva, how active it really is. God, make us return or let us return ourselves. But, and then chadesh yameinu kekedem, God, you make our days the way they used to be. So there's a certain amount of passivity there. So I think that there's a combination, right? And of course, that's the message of the continuity of the Jewish people as well, right? You have the perhaps more passive and waiting, just like the woman did in our last midrash, but not just waiting, waiting with Torah, with faith, but also the necessity of action as well, that we need to do what we can to help ourselves as individuals and, of course, as a people. So the waiting, the faith, the Torah, as well as human action towards a successful Jewish future.